This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
BFM 89.9, I'm Sherrod Kutin, and on the breakfast grill with me this morning is Martin Jakes, author of the best-selling book titled When China Rules the World. It was first published in 2009, has since been translated into 15 languages, and has sold over 400,000 copies. The book has been shortlisted for some major literary awards, and Martin's TED Talk on how to understand China has had over 2 million views. Millions seem small when talking about China. A country for its sheer size and deep history really evokes a whole range of superlatives. Thank you so much for joining us this morning. It's great timing. Of course, our Prime Minister has been in China, and the deals of the magnitude we have, 144 billion ringgit is being talked about, the numbers being mentioned in the press. I wanted to begin with this very simple story that's come out of Europe, Martin. Germany's EU commissioner, Gunther Oettinger, came out and made a reference to Chinese people and Asians as having slitty eyes. And this has evoked some response from the Chinese. And I wonder if this, along with the fact that Berlin has pushed back on some major attempts at acquisitions of industries in Germany, tells us something about the view of China in Europe, that in some sense it's viewed with some fear.
Well, I'm not familiar with this quote. It's obviously out of order. I think that European attitudes are quite complex towards China. I mean, historically, the Europeans looked down on the Chinese when they were extremely poor and regarded themselves to be superior to China. And I would say that while there's historically at times been great interest in China and its culture and so on, also it's regarded as the other, you know, and the knowledge can be quite dismissive about it. And then, of course, since 1949 and Mao's revolution and Communist Party rule, there's a kind of Cold War, I'm going to call it a Cold War element to European attitudes. And then there's the fact that China is so big and so different evokes, I mean, I think it's the sheer size of China in a way that evokes a fear that this country is so large. So the Europeans, they are much more positive now towards China than they were, say, 20 years ago, because they've been impressed by what China's achieved and also have regard to the fact that now the Chinese economy is the second largest in the world, then it offers opportunities.
They're kind of ambivalent about these opportunities, aren't they? We've had the pushback on ChemChina's attempt to buy Syngenta, a pushback on the attempt to buy the Axtron Group by Chinese investors. We have, in fact, the deputy economics minister from Germany who told the Financial Times that while the government of Germany welcomed foreign investment, it was wary of deals that seemed to be state-directed and were only about gaining access to German technology rather than about Germany as an investment destination. This is the reasoning given by the German government on sort of putting the brakes on Chinese investments in Germany. What do you read, you know, between the lines of these statements?
Well, I think there is a bit of a pushback at the moment on investment and a resistance, a sort of feel the need to scrutinize deals to a greater extent. What is all that about? Well, I mean, certainly the flow of Chinese investment into Europe and indeed into other countries as well, of course, has greatly expanded over the last few years. And so this is a sort of new element, a new dimension to China's economic relationship with Europe. China has bought already quite a few, what I was going to say, technology companies, but, you know, companies with superior technology to China, that's not a new development. And this is particularly true in Germany. So what's going on? I think it's partly to do with the fact that, firstly, the levels of Chinese investment have increased a lot. And secondly, I think the West at the moment in particular is characterized by this kind of growing introversion, you know, a sort of a slightly nativist mentality.
You're drawing up the drawbridge,
yes,
pulling up the drawbridge.
Yeah. I mean, obviously Brexit in my own country is the outstanding example of this. But everywhere you look in Europe, you can see this trend. And,
but there's something about the Chinese. I mean, if it was a Japanese company buying into a German technology company, would there be as much concern? We see concerns in Australia and other parts of the world. And the question is, should we give some credence to these concerns? I mean, after
all... You're right. I mean, if it was a Japanese firm, a big Japanese firm bought a major... a British technology company, and it was warmly welcomed by the government. If it had been Chinese, there would have been an argument about it. Why? Well, the argument would have been, you know, it's really back to the things that I was saying. It is because there is a certain fear of China, which is based on, one, a Cold War mentality. It's a different kind of society. It's organized in a different kind of way with different kind of political arrangements. And secondly, China is so big. I mean, China is 10 times, more than 10 times the size of Japan.
Martin, the flip side of that narrative is the love fest that's going on with third world nations for China. I mean, not only in Malaysia, Xi Jinping was just in Bangladesh, and the magnitude of the deals being signed in Dhaka were similar to Malaysia. You know, $40 billion in infrastructure projects there around the world, across the globe, one belt, one road, maritime silk road, whatever you want to call it. Nations are lapping up Chinese money. They're embracing the Chinese. And what do you think is going on there? And should they themselves be a little careful?
The broad trend you're talking about, of course, is true. I think that it's wrong to say that these governments don't think about it. I mean, for example, some of the deals in Africa have been redone as a result of a growing sort of wisening up by African governments about making sure it's a more equal deal than they thought they were getting before. But, of course, the main brunt of the point you're making is true, which is this extraordinary outward-going movement from China. I mean, we've never seen anything ever in Chinese history quite like this before. And why? Well, you know, it's 1.3 billion people. It's been growing like crazy. Even now, it's still growing, you know, 6.5-7%, something like that. And the result of that is that China needs the rest of the world, just like the rest of the world now needs China.
We know, of course, with, say, the US and the West, that along with trade has been the trade in political values, or the attempt to, and some people see it, or some nations see it, as the imposition of Western values. You know, you might call them Enlightenment values, you might call them, you might park it under the rubric of democracy. There is, with China, no such thing, it seems. But is that true? I would like to cite the example of the Global Times attacking Singapore for its... apparent neutrality over the South China Sea issue. The Global Times seemed to be a kind of a mouthpiece of the Communist Party. Attack Singapore. Why wasn't it more loyal to China? Why didn't it stand for China? Why is it, you know, posturing as neutral in this contest between the US and China? Is that what China wants at the end of the day? Not to make countries democratic, but make them loyal to China?
Well, I think that is a very crude presentation, actually, of China. I mean, China does have a different relationship to the developing world to that of the West. And I would say the difference is this, that China, as a developing country, has an affinity with other developing countries which the West simply doesn't enjoy because it doesn't know. So China knows what developing countries need. What is their offer? It is development. That is what the offer of the One Belt, One Road is. Look, we achieved our change, as they see it, by this very rapid economic growth as a result of large-scale investment, especially in infrastructure. You can do the same.
But what about the question of democracy? We know, of course, that in these deals, what it tends to do is to strengthen the hand of local authoritarian leaders. They're getting huge infusion of cash.
That's not necessarily the case at all. I don't think that's a particular pattern. The point that's normally made, and there is that, well, the Chinese, unlike the United States, don't affix political conditions. Oh, the American tradition goes back to colonialism and Western colonialism. They always fix political conditions.
Well, what about loyalty? I mean, in the case of Singapore and the Global Times attack on Singapore, wasn't loyalty at the base of it? They also, I think it was said, I mean, these are just
As you've quoting the Global Times twice now, I should tell you that that is hotly debated, the subject of Singapore, because a lot of people disagreed with the Global Times attack on. I mean, for example, I was reading an article the other day by Zhu Feng, who heads up the South China Sea Institute in Nanjing University, who's a leading figure in China, and he said, no, that's quite wrong. You know, you've got to remember, often people outside China don't know this, but there are really lively, hard-hitting debates going on. It's not sort of one person talking with one voice.
What is it that China offers the world in terms of a model for growth as well as governance?
Well, I think what it offers, or what's proven remarkably successful, we'd have to agree, I think, is a hybrid model which draws influences from other East Asian countries, historically, from the West. It's learned various things in the West, some things from the United States, some things from Europe, and so on. But contained within a view of which is both post 1949, but also much older, going back a long time in Chinese history, of the importance of the state. And I think that Chinese governance is very distinctive from that of the West. And the debate around governance is changing. 10 years ago, 20 years ago, if we were having this discussion, maybe even 5 years ago, you know, the China was on the defensive and the West was attacking. And what? Why? Because the argument about governance was simply, basically, how do you choose government? Do you have elections and multi-party system or not? But now the debate has shifted, and it will continue to shift, in my view, towards the question of competence and delivery. And here the Chinese are, of course, on very strong ground. And increasingly, if you look at the West, it's on very increasingly weak ground because they're not delivering. And these systems are not working so well. So I think we're moving. You know, the rise of China is not simply, you can't just talk about this in narrow political terms. You've got to see this as the rise of a country, a very old country, at least 2,000 years continuously existing polity with two different traditions, different values. It is entering the global sphere, and it is going to help to shape that sphere in a way that previously, when it was poor, it was an outsider and no one listened to it.
We're speaking to Martin Jacks, author of the best-selling book titled When China Rules the World. Next up, we ask if China's global dominance is inevitable. I'm Sherrod Kutin on BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, if you just joined us, I'm Sherrod Kutin. And on the Breakfast Grill with me this morning is Martin Jacks, author of the best-selling book titled When China Rules the World. We ended up talking about the governance argument. I live in Southeast Asia. I grew up in Singapore. I know what an authoritarian regime talks about when it tries to establish legitimacy. It talks about performance. That's what Singapore and the PAP have always talked about. 50 years of good governance, but authoritarian rule. Is that the future for most Asians? Of course, people want to make a good living. They want to have good lives, but they also want voice. And that's what the authoritarian system robs people of, its citizens of. It gives them the goods, but it takes away their voice.
Does it? I mean, I don't think it's quite so conclusive as that. I agree with you that this is quite a common feature of this part of the world, East Asia, I mean, Singapore. You know, and Malaysia's had the same party in government ever since independence. And Vietnam, if you look around the region, you know, okay, then you'll say, well, Japan's a democracy, and I'll say to you, well, the Liberal Democrats have been more or less continuously in power ever since the war, with two very brief exceptions. So there's a pattern here, isn't there? And I think the pattern is built up to do with the culture. You know, the cultures are different in East Asia. The way the political systems work are different. They're much more familial in principle, because the family is so important, not just in the Confucian societies, but also in, you know, in say in Malaysia and so on. So I would expect to have a different kind of political system. There's a very good book by, alas, dead now, Lucian Pai, Asian Power and Politics, American, excellent American sinologist. And he said the trouble with the way the West looks at politics is that we preoccupy ourselves with political systems. Actually, what is much more important is political cultures.
In this debate that's happening globally, do you think that China has the power to shape or reshape Europe? You know, you have China buying into, say, a car manufacturer like Volvo. And with Volvo now, they're kind of saying, well, you know, you want to shape the redesign the car a bit to suit Chinese tastes. We see that in terms of product. We also know that Yum China is an American brand that has spun off a Chinese unit. Yum China is now going to push something called the Mongolian pot. You know, okay, these are superficial examples. Deeper down, do you think that China will win the argument on governance in substantive ways, that it will start to shape the politics of countries around the world, including Europe?
Well, up to a point, it will have that effect. But I would say only up to a point. You know, Europe has a long history. That history is not going to be nullified by the rise of China and the Chinese model. What might happen, and I think probably will happen, is that Western countries will be obliged to think about China, learn from China. I mean, what does China do? China learned from the West. Not exclusively. A lot of it's homegrown, but it also definitely learned from the West. Why shouldn't the West be learning from China, for example, or Japan? It did learn from Japan for a period, not so much now. And just on your point about Geely and Volvo, I mean, I know this example very well. Actually, you know, Geely, the Chinese company, car manufacturer, saved Volvo, I mean, and has turned out to, I think, virtually everyone's surprised, to be a far better proprietor of Volvo than Ford, who bought it. I mean, there's now a range of new models. They've invested lots of money. And I was reading an article in the Financial Times to say, actually, the governance principles of Volvo now, ironically, are much better than they were before. If it hadn't been for the Chinese intervention, there wouldn't be a Volvo anymore as a major car manufacturer in Sweden. So the Swedes have a very positive view of what's happened, to their surprise in many cases.
The rise of China is, I think, a fact that nobody disputes at this point in time. The question of whether China will rule the world, will dominate it, is still contested. Do you think there are reasons to believe that this is not inevitable, that China's global dominance is not inevitable? I like to cite, for example, concerns about China's financial architecture, you know, its debt level. All these are now mounting concerns about whether China's growth can be sustained over the long term.
I mean, it's very difficult to project a long way into the future, but what I would say to this is, first of all, you know, there's been constant, you know the story, constant bearish sentiment in the West about the prospects for the Chinese economy. This isn't new. It's been going on for decades. Ever since Deng Xiaoping started the reforms, the West have sort of basically felt that they were not going to succeed. And what is now clear, looking back at the last 35 odd years, is that China has had extraordinary momentum and traction in its transformation. And I don't see at the moment any reason to revise that view. I think China is not going to stop, but this is going to carry on for quite a long time with problems, with difficulties and so on. But I think the rise of China is, you know, one of those sort of elemental forces of nature, in a sense, like the rise of America was after the
Civil
War.
But not a historic inevitability, right? I mean,
there will be lots of textures. The point is this, of course, you know, there are limits to what China can achieve. And China at some point could overreach itself. It could take on too much. It could go into one belt, one road and really not have the financial resources to handle it because maybe the growth rate declines. I mean, you know, China will be subject to some of the same forces as every other country in relationship to these things. So inevitability, yeah, I think it's very likely, I'm not inevitable, very likely China...
Well, the Chinese rise, yes, but dominance, it's a question of dominance.
Dominance, China's, I mean, I used...
That's the title of your book, Rule the World.
I used the expression, when I rule the world, rather like if I sang the song, if I rule the world. I didn't... People who sing the song don't think they're going to rule the world. China is never going to rule the world because no country can ever rule the world because the world is too big for any country to do that. What I meant was China will become the dominant country in the world. Do I think that's going to be the case? Yes, I do think that. But I think there'll be all sorts of limits on what its power is. You know, the rise is not... I mean, I do happen to think that although the United States is the most obvious constraint on China, the United States is probably historically in more rapid, precipitous decline than any of us could possibly have imagined. But that doesn't mean there aren't other countries that are going to exercise constraints on China. For example, India over time will become, I hope, a very powerful force in its own right.
Maybe the subject of your next book, that massive behemoth of a nation, but a very soft state, quite unlike China. And I want to talk about a little bit about the Communist Party now and its future. We know Xi Jinping is leading the pact, as it were, but he is looking, so critics say, more and more like the next helmsman. You know,
the great helmsman,
along with Mao Zedong. And then because Deng Xiaoping, that Xi Jinping is going to be, not just the first among equals, but in fact, you know, the supreme leader. And one of these
concerns... now described as the core of the leadership.
And he has been concerned about the future of the Communist Party. He looks back at Gorbachev and what he did with glasnost and perestroika. He doesn't want the Communist Party to land up on the dustbin or the dust heap of history. Is Xi Jinping crucial to the story that you're telling about China?
Well, he's obviously not crucial to the story so far because he's only been in office since 2012, which is, 4 years, something like that. So he's not the maker of where China's got to since 1949, especially since the reform period in 1978. Is he crucial to the future? Well, certainly he has been reshaping China in important respects. Above all, the thing I would most emphasize is that up until 2012, China's approach, China's strategy was essentially that of Deng Xiaoping, which was economic growth and the reduction of poverty. Everything else, including foreign policy, subordinated to these ends. Brilliantly successful strategy. And by 2012, China was no longer weak. It was, in some important senses, a very strong country. Xi Jinping's angle on this was the Chinese dream, in a way. Look, we've reached a point that we never thought was never possible before, but now we can dream. You know, in the Deng period, we couldn't dream because we just had to have our nose to the grindstone to achieve this economic transformation. But now we can begin to ask questions like, you know, what sort of society do we want to have? And in particular, I would add, what sort of role do we want China to play in the world? So really, until that point, you know, China being, hiding, in Deng's language, hiding its capability, not showing leadership, being very cautious, winning as many friends as possible. Under Xi Jinping, you can see it's opened up now. So it's not just about economic transformation. It's also China's development as a comprehensive power in their language, you know, political power, cultural power, ideological power, military power. China is becoming an all-round power, not yet a superpower, but certainly, you know, not too far away now from being a great power. That is Xi's contribution so far.
If I may be so cheeky, I suggest we put on our dialectical hat as youth former editor of Marxism Today. I'm sure it's in your back pocket somewhere. What are the kind of contradictions that are going to surface as a consequence of this trajectory that China's taking? One party state, freewheeling capitalism on the other. What could arise from this odd mix?
Maybe it's not odd. We just think it's odd, but because we're not used to it. But maybe it's not odd. Maybe there's actually quite a symmetry about it. We just think it's peculiar because we haven't witnessed it before and it's so different from what we are. China's a fantastically difficult country to govern. A fifth of the world's population existing within the same borders. It's almost impossible, apart perhaps from India, for any country to really understand that problem. This is the conundrum of China. What is the great strength of China? The great strength of China is its size. What is the great weakness of China? The great weakness of China is its size. It's a very, very difficult country to run. And historically, you know, it's had I mean, it's been a very successful country, as you know. It's not just had one or two periods under the sun. It's had several periods, you know, the Tang Dynasty, the Song Dynasty, the Ming Dynasty, part of the Qing Dynasty. China's been one of the top, if not the top country in certain respects in all those periods for a while. But then it goes in decline. It's been a cycle of extraordinary effervescence, if you like, and then terrible decline, a century of humiliation. When I'm talking about the rise of China, I think this era, this century is the rise of China. It won't go on forever. Nothing goes on forever. At some point, these contradictions will become too much. Maybe rising inequality is a big problem in China. I mean, look what it's doing to the United States now. Look what it did to done to Britain. There's a feedback loop with inequality, and it will affect China as well. But I don't think it's all going to end in tears shortly. I think, you know, the Western view, which is it's all going to end in a minute, you know, just, you know, China's unsustainable. The economic transformation will come to an end. It'll hit the wall. Why? Because the political system is unsustainable. I don't buy all that. I think that is very unlikely. But in the longer run, of course, it will not carry on forever.
Thank you very much. I've been speaking to Martin Jacques, author of the best-selling When China Rules the World, subtitled The End of the Western World and the Birth of a New Global Order. I'm Sharad Kutin, and you're listening to The Breakfast Grill on BFM 89.9, The Business Station.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, The Business Station.